8 октября Замоскворецкий суд Москвы признал...
Михаил Косенко сегодня отправлен на принудительное лечение.
В психиатрической клинике.
На Болотной площади Михаил Косенко был обычным...
Это решение возвратом к советской методике помещения диссидентов...
Узник совести или опасный преступник? Мы попробуем...
He's a 38-year-old Muscovite with a disability. He came to Bolotnaya Square on May 6, 2012, on the eve of Vladimir Putin's inauguration, to demand free elections. And he was in the wrong place at the wrong time. Mikhail Kosenko this week became the third of 27 defendants in the so-called Bolotnaya case to be convicted of participating in mass disturbances. But his case has resonated like no other. Kosenko, who suffered a concussion while serving in the military and has been since receiving outpatient treatment for a mild psychological disorder, was sentenced to a psychiatric ward against the advice of his doctors. Moreover, video footage show him simply standing by while protesters scuffled with police. The police officer, who Kosenko is charged with attacking, actually testified in his defense, wished him well, and said he should not be incarcerated. In Kosenko's eloquent and passionate closing statement at his trial, in which he offered heartfelt thanks to those who supported him and argued that society's highest value is freedom, has made him a more sympathetic figure still. Alexei Navalny, who himself stole the show at his own show trial, called Kosenko an example to us all. Has the Kremlin inadvertently created another martyr hero? Hello and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from London is co-host Kirill Kobrin, editor of the history and sociology magazine NZ. Welcome, Kirill.
Hello.
And also joining us via Skype from Moscow is special guest and veteran Kremlin watcher David Satter, a longtime Moscow correspondent, a fellow at the John Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, and author of numerous books on Russia, including most recently, It Was a Long Time Ago and It Never Happened Anyway. Welcome back, David.
Thank you.
I've always thought the Bolotnaya case was particularly dangerous for the Kremlin for a very simple reason. While some of the defendants are activists, members of the professional opposition, if you will, most are not. They're electricians, they're chemists, they're artists, they're travel agents, they're insurance brokers, they're students. In short, they're ordinary people. And they have parents and siblings and children and friends who also have parents and children and siblings and friends and so on and so on and so on. In a sense, they're everybody. And Kosenko, who has evoked so much sympathy and support, drives this point home. In a blog post after the verdict, the prominent Echo Moscovy journalist Anton Orekh wrote, "The court has found itself insane." Earlier in the week, I spoke to the London-based writer and Kremlin watcher Peter Pomerantsev, whose most recent piece on Russia we'll be discussing in the second half of the program, and asked him what the Kremlin was trying to accomplish here and whether it might be backfiring. To get the ball rolling, let's all just listen to what Peter had to say.
I think it's very important to understand why the Kremlin uses show trials, using them as a show of force. It's the very absurdity of the verdict, as in the case of Navalny, as in the case with Khodorkovsky, and now with Kosenko. This very idea that the verdict is absurd is the very point. It's more sort of an insistence on its own kind of omnipotence. What might be changing, and what is fascinating, is that maybe that show of omnipotence isn't appealing anymore. Because if beforehand it was the Kremlin saying, look at us, we're so strong, you know, don't even think about going against us, because we will think up a charge tomorrow and put you in prison. It's whether that show of machismo is appealing. And maybe for a certain type of Russian, they're not finding it appealing anymore. And they're not finding it frightening anymore. They're finding it sort of crass and unappealing.
So, David, what are your thoughts on Peter's observation there? Is the Kremlin, the old Kremlin bag of tricks, losing its punch?
Of course, they are attempting to frighten people. And the question is really, how much further do they intend to go? I think that the measures that they've adopted so far are not going to be sufficient to achieve the goals that they've set themselves, which are to keep civil society under control, to stifle opposition, So the real likelihood is that they'll engender more opposition and that the opposition will radicalize. So I think that all of this is nothing so much as a sign that the situation in Russia is becoming unstable. To resort to psychiatric repression again after 20 years or 20 plus years after the fall of the Soviet Union, and to do so so obviously, is a sign that the regime is relying on force, but so far doesn't have the wherewithal to use massive force. Where it's going to go is anyone's guess, but it's certainly not going to go in the direction of stabilization.
Do you think that cases like Bolotnaya that actually touch on ordinary people, I mean, most of these, Kosenko is a Moscow everyman in a lot of ways, and in his case in particular, the video footage shows him just to be standing by and in no way attacking police officers. He was named a prisoner of conscience by Amnesty recently. Does this case resonate more than, say, a case against a Navalny or somebody who is more of an oppositionist, where these are just, a lot of these people are just, as I said, ordinary folks? Is this more dangerous for the Kremlin in that sense?
Yeah, I mean, this is deliberate. I mean, this is an attempt to warn every ordinary citizen who may consider taking part in a demonstration that he risks not coming home from that demonstration, or he risks a long prison term. The idea is to make it clear that it is not safe just to be standing in the crowd. And I think that that it's not going to work, that it takes a lot more than that to intimidate masses of people. And the provocations are going to continue. I mean, the discontent is going to grow, and the situation is going to become more serious.
Kirill, what about Peter Pomerantsev's comment that maybe for a certain kind of Russian isn't finding this frightening anymore? They're finding it crass and unappealing, and therefore it's not having the intended effect that David just spelled out. Do you see this spreading? Is this having the opposite effect of rather of not scaring people, but in fact inciting them?
I agree with Peter Pomerantsev, but just partially. Of course, it's a show of force because the set of instruments which usually used by authoritarian regimes, this collection is very limited, yes, and force is one of the most important tools. And Kremlin used this tool effectively, in some sense, effectively, through the first decade of 21st century. But now it's not such effective. The question is why. That is my second and third point. The second point is that don't forget about the traditional Russian chaos.
Because, how could you?
So I can imagine this municipal or district court where Kosenko's trial was. I can imagine all these judges with their backgrounds and so on, and they received an order to do something with this guy and so on, and they tried desperately to do something. But don't forget that even the policeman who initially accused Kosenko that he hit him, yeah? He then after, in the end of the process,
in the trial, the policeman actually said, "I don't recognize him.
Yes,
he is not the one that hit me."
Yes, initially he wrote in his report
that, right?
Yes, and then he. So it's very interesting. So if you are, you know, if you are authoritarian regime and so on, you must prepare all this thing, you know, more professional. And the third point is that it's unprofessional, not just in an administrative or some, you know, instrumental sense. Putin's regime is becoming very ineffective in a very important field, in the political field itself. It's a very wrong target, Mikhail Kosenko. He is not intellectual. He is not, as you told, he is not, he's an everyman, yeah? He is not a member of so-called creative class or something like this. He's just ordinary man with, by the way, as far as I know, with the police background.
Well, he suffered a concussion during his military service. I know that. He's been receiving outpatient treatment for a mild psychiatric disorder, but nothing terribly serious.
Absolutely.
He's an incredibly sympathetic figure, and that came through in the trial. And the cruelty with which he has been treated. Now, his mother recently died, and he was not allowed to be released from pretrial detention to attend his mother's funeral. The absurd reason the authorities gave is this is only a right for people who have already been convicted. So if you're pretrial detention and not convicted of anything, you cannot get out to attend your mother's funeral. But if you're a convicted murderer, I assume you can get furloughed for the day to go pay your last respects to your mother. So the cruelty with which this man has been treated, and this has resonated. I wanted to get kind of David, because you get some interesting historical perspective on this. I mean, you covered the dissident movement in the 70s and 80s, and how important are symbols like Kosenko, these everymen that get caught up in this and become victims. How important is he now as a symbol for the democratic movement in Russia?
Well, during the Soviet times, the ordinary citizens who got caught up one way or the other disappeared into psychiatric hospitals and rarely became symbols because their fate was not well known. It was, generally speaking, the intellectual dissidents, the people with connections in Moscow, who became better known. I think that we are in a different era, of course, and the fact that this is an ordinary person is perhaps less important than the fact that he symbolizes in his fate the fact that the Soviet Union's methods are being reintroduced. That's something that everybody can object to and be aware of and understand the danger of. So the question that his fate poses, in my opinion, is whether it's really impossible to instill fear on a mass basis, you know, fear of taking part in a demonstration, fear of getting involved. He's supposed to, from the point of view of the regime and the other Bolotny defendants, are supposed to be a message to the population as a whole, not just those who are likely to be active opponents of the regime, but of those who are likely to give it their passive support, that such support is dangerous and can lead to very, very serious negative consequences.
So your assessment, if I'm hearing you correctly, is the Kosenko thing might be in the short term it might be working for the regime, but in the long term it's doomed because this mass of people that are becoming less and less afraid is only going to grow. Would that be correct?
I'm not sure it'll work even in the short term. The intention is to make people afraid to participate in demonstrations in the short term. And my guess is that two things will happen. First of all, that it will, on the contrary, inspire greater resistance, and also that it will contribute to a potentially dangerous development, which is the radicalization of the opposition.
Mm. Kirill, what about you? How potent a symbol do you think Kosenko is right now?
I think that the consequences of this trial and then this verdict, but it's still, you know, unclear what will go on with this, because just today, so-called Совет по правам человека при президенте, it's a council on human rights.
Council on human rights.
Yes, told that this verdict is absolutely ridiculous. Mm-hmm. It's a very strong gesture. By the way, it's a presidential body, so it's. I'm not sure that the story is ended with this verdict and so on. But I agree with David. Even in a short perspective, it's not a very good move by Kremlin to treat this Mikhail Kosenko so with such cruelty and so on. Of course, they try to show their force and try to intimidate those who maybe theoretically would join the protests or demonstrations and so on in Moscow. But they could threaten even just those people who are, you know, intelligentsia or some, you know, people will not go to demonstrations with their children and so on, as it was, you know, initially in 2011 and 2012. But they will have a very big crowd of a very strong men, not such peaceful, instead of absolutely peaceful, intelligent mm-hmm. demonstrations. So that is very important, and that is very, you know, dangerous in some sense. I'd like to return to this gesture of this policeman who said he didn't see, he haven't seen Mikhail Kasenko fighting with the police. That was a sort of sympathy to his, you know, say, romantically brother in arms.
Yeah, it could be. And this police officer also wished Kasenko well. He wished him that his health would improve. And he said he should definitely not be incarcerated. Couldn't this be the Kirill, you say the idea is that people are going to be afraid to go to demonstrations and not take their children. Couldn't that be the idea from the Kremlin's point to make the opposition just look a little bit scarier? So they can demonize them still?
Initially, I think that was a strategy by Kremlin in the very beginning of 2012 to intimidate the creative class, the Moscow intelligentsia, and so on, with the show trials. And that was the initial point of all this Bolotnaya process. But now I'm absolutely sure, now they don't know what to do with all this. And it's not such effective because, of course, they cut off some people who are not in mood to risk with all these things, but participating in the protests and so on. But now the common or public attitude to Kremlin is much more, you know, harsher than it was, 6 months ago. Now the situation becoming more and more serious, and Kremlin is doing one by one several grave political and especially public PR mistakes. And I think this Kasenko trial is one of these mistakes. For instance, they absolutely forgot about Udaltsov, who is a very useful target for Kremlin, and they concentrated on, you know, absolutely innocent people. I'm not speaking that Udaltsov is not innocent, but they can use the very figure of Udaltsov as a symbol of, you know, any, you know, foreign influence on the Russian political process and so on. Kasenko couldn't be used in such way.
To illustrate your point that they may be having second thoughts, there's been talk from Putin himself and from leading members of the Duma of a potential amnesty for the Bolotnaya protesters.
They are not sure what to do next. And I think that just now when we're speaking and discussing all those things, they sit somewhere in some, you know, special Kremlin committee or something, discussing what to do next with Kasenko and all with all these people. Because from the point of view of political PR, the situation is disastrous for Kremlin now in this particular field. Yeah,
David, any last thoughts on this before we move on to the second segment?
Well, only that I think that this is a game without permanent rules, and that the regime is not committed to one outcome or another. Not in this case. Not with Kharkovsky. Not with Navalny. They're manipulating the situation as they go along, trying to maintain a certain equilibrium in which they remain on top in the society, and whatever methods seem to work at a given time they use. It's by no means as rigid or as predictable as the Soviet system.
Well, that's an excellent segue into the second half of our program. In a few moments, we will continue our discussion, broaden the aperture a bit, and look at the virtual politics of what Peter Pomerantsev, in a paper published this week, called Russia's Postmodern Dictatorship. I would like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from London is co-host Kirill Kobrin, editor of the history and sociology magazine NZ. And also joining us via Skype from Moscow is special guest and veteran Kremlin watcher David Satter, a longtime Moscow correspondent, a fellow at the John Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, and author of numerous books on Russia, including my personal favorite, Darkness at Dawn, The Rise of the Russian Criminal State. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
The kind of doublethink that we saw in the Soviet Union, it's continued. So it's actually become more refined and more nuanced and more playful, if anything. Listen, still 50% of the so-called new Russian middle class is actually working for the state. Far more are working for companies which are somehow connected to the state. Russian still has one face that he wears in all his sort of like, you know, relationships with the tax authorities or with the police, and another one that he has within his private sphere, that schizophrenic division between public morality and private morality, which is really the great crisis in Russia, that continues.
An elite that has learned to use the techniques of democracy for distinctly undemocratic ends and has a, quote, liquid shape-shifting approach to power. A system that works not by suppressing opposition narratives, but by co-opting them until there is no more space for the opposition to exist in. A regime that has managed to marry authoritarianism and modern art, to use the language of rights and representation in order to validate tyranny, and to recut and paste democratic capitalism until it means the reverse of its original purpose. This is the picture of contemporary Russia that Kremlin watcher and London-based writer Peter Pomerantsev presents in his latest work, Russia, a Postmodern Dictatorship, which was published by the Legatom Institute and the Institute of Modern Russia this week. When I spoke to Peter about his paper, I asked him how this system, which worked so well for the past decade or so, is faring now that it is being challenged by a rising class that appears to be tired of virtual politics and yearns for something more authentic. We've all read Peter's report, so to get the discussion moving, let's listen to what he had to say about this.
Looking at it in a kind of big, wide shot way, of course it's still working. Putin is still very much in charge. It's still this is still a culture that is very much about shows of strength, and it's not a Woody Allen kind of culture. However, there is clearly bits of society. There's a new kind of consciousness starting to brood in Russia, and so there's a certain type of person that's appeared which doesn't like it anymore. But overall, if you look at the wide context of things, of course it still works. What's so fascinating for us Russia watchers is to watch this kind of new consciousness appearing. And the fact is that we didn't exist before. So the fact that it's appeared makes it feel very, very big.
Are we seeing the birth of a new post-Soviet man right now in that sense?
Yes. I think so. I think that is exactly what we've seen. Actually, he's always existed. I mean, in my paper, I call them Russia's first Protestants because they reflect the values of Max Weber's idea of sort of a Protestant work ethic. A lot of these people, for example, who were working for Navalny, work in the sciences. They're small businessmen. They work in Western companies. They work in IT. So they have this sort of scientific, rational way of thinking around the world. They want to see justice. You know, they think black should be black and white should be white, and a spade is a spade. And it's about sort of how they make their money. They have small businesses, so they have to function rationally. And when they're faced with an irrational system, they kind of push back. So yes, I think that's exactly what we're seeing. Of course, there's been people like that in Russia before, but what we're seeing for the first time is them form as a political class. And that's what's fascinating. I call it almost the revolution of the nerds. It's people who've walked out of the set of the Big Bang Theory and into Russian political discourse. And it's very exciting and also very fearful as they try to sort of grow muscle and turn into a real political class.
Well, the post-post-Soviet man, the revolution of the nerds, the Big Bang Theory invades Russia. God help us. We got a lot to talk about here. And it seems like we got some new buzz phrases. Kirill, what are your thoughts on this? I mean, on one hand, we have this system, this authoritarian system that has managed to, as Peter points out in his paper, kind of incorporate the language and symbols of democracy for undemocratic ends, that managed to co-opt opposition narratives. That's a shape-shifting kind of virtual reality out there. And on the other hand, we have what he calls the Russia's first Protestants, these people in the revolution of the nerds, these people that are hyper-rational, that want a more authentic politics. How would you react to that? What are your thoughts on that?
I read Peter's report, or analytical report, I think. It's a very interesting document. And I agree with most of his points, but I can't agree with his term postmodernist when we speak about modern Russia. It's not a postmodernist. In the academic sense, of course, by the way, he's using phrase society of spectacle as one of the main features of postmodernist society, but society of spectacle, this Guy Debord phrase, it's not about postmodernism, nothing to do with postmodernism. It's not all about, you know, so-called capitalist society.
But I think he was most referring to the shape-shifting nature of it, the ability to co-opt opposition narratives. Yeah. I think that's
it's a very narrow academic consideration, so I'm not, you know, insisting on this. But speaking more seriously, it's not a sort of postmodernist project, because, first of all, postmodernism is based on the irony and the detachment from the very, you know, from the very object and subject, saying in philosophical words. So it's not any, you know, trace of irony in modern Russian politics. It's not about playing with them, ready-made ideological things, and so on. I think Putin's regime is a result of a very chaotic and very pragmatic process of trying to escape founding something powerful in some sense, like that was Soviet Union. So I can explain. Now, all this, you know, speeches, all these discussions, all this, you know, even gestures towards a new Russian ideology. This is the result of the lack of ideological basis of this new regime. At some point, this regime decided that, okay, we'll imitate the ideology, but we'll not play seriously with this. We couldn't explain ourselves to the society. That's why we try at the same time to entertain the society with pop culture and so on.
Right, but that's the point. But on the other hand, you have these Big Bang Theory nerds who want something rational. They don't want to be entertained. By their politicians. They want as Peter pointed out, black is black and white is white and a spade is a spade.
I'm not sure that white is white and black is black. So black is black because of, you know, all the history of European philosophy discussing this and can't go to any conclusions. But what is very important in what Peter Pomerantsev wrote and was speaking about is that the difference between Russia 2000s and Russia, you know, say 2013, is a very serious interest to the problem of values. It's all about values now. Cultural values, moral values, ethical, or something like this. You know, a president and, you know, his aides are speaking about, you know, our special Russian tradition values. Navalny is speaking about morals and ethics and so on from the another point of view. But anyway, he's speaking about values.
Yeah.
Yes, all these people who worked in this Navalny electoral campaign, they were speaking about values, some other values. It's very interesting that every side of modern Russian political process is speaking about values, cultural, political, whatever. But it's a very interesting change from the situation of 2000, which was, you know, quite cynical.
Right. David, what are your thoughts on this showdown, if you will, between the postmodern dictatorship and the Big Bang Theory nerds, and the in terms of values and power and everything? How do you see this?
I think that what's happening is that many people who are perfectly competent technocrats and computer specialists and modern members of society are finding that in a country where the political regime consists of a few people who have known each other for a long time and are intent on passing on power and property to their children and their connections, that these people, I mean the competent, well-educated, worldly members of the society who could get jobs elsewhere, have little future. Their future is blocked. They're compelled to live and work in an unnatural situation in which they're obliged to participate in illegal and immoral and dishonest activities, or at least not to protest against them. And of course, this creates tension. The kind of regime that exists in Russia now can only exist under conditions in which popular dissatisfaction doesn't become too great, because it doesn't have the protection of an ideology on the one hand, and it doesn't have the capacity to use massive repression on the other. The reason it can't use massive repression is because its base is too narrow. So we've entered into a period of maneuvering in which the regime is trying through various means to keep the population on the one hand intimidated and on the other hand pacified, is using different tactics. How long this can go on is a matter of conjecture, but we see that the trends in Russia are not positive. Economic trends are not positive. And in general, the regime has been in place for a long time, and the longer it stays in place, the more resentment it breeds. So we have a situation which is unstable and becoming more so.
And potentially explosive.
Possibly.
Now, in preparing his report, Peter Pomerantsev spent a lot of time in Moscow with the Navalny volunteers during the electoral campaign. When I spoke to him this week, he indicated they clearly believe the time is on their side, nevertheless, in this situation. Let's listen to what Peter had to say here.
When I talk to sort of the support, not even the supporters of Navalny, but the people, the volunteers, the people who are working for him, who I found much more interesting than he could ever be, I kept on asking them, so, you know, you're doing all this stuff, you realize what you're doing is tiny, you realize the Kremlin is sucking you into its game, that it's going to spin you, that it's going to turn, you know, Navalny into part of the system, there's no way out of this hall of mirrors that they've created. The genius of sort of postmodern dictatorship is it can suck in anything new and co-opt it. And they're like, yeah, we understand all that. And they all talk about, they don't do it in a religious way, obviously, but they do all talk about a certain X point when the system as we know it will buckle. And they've all, you know, they're all very keen on shale gas and such things. So everybody does talk about a certain moment simply when the system just can't financially feed all its underlings.
David, what do you think? Is that what we're headed for? You seem to be getting at that in your earlier comments.
Well, I think that the regime is facing a future crisis over because it's based on oil and gas revenues, and those are going to suffer. And forces of opposition are building, discontent is building. How it's all going to turn out is anybody's guess. The important thing really is that the opposition understand that the problem is deeper than the regime. The problem is an entire political culture that existed under the czars, under the Soviets. It exists now under Yeltsin, under Putin. And as long as the individual is not respected in Russia, and his life is not considered to be valuable, and history is not conveyed truthfully, a change in the regime will not necessarily lead to something better. So right now, for me, the real question is not that whether or not there's a confrontation brewing. I think there is. And I think, you know, it's not difficult to see it. But the question is, what's being done by the opposition in order to prepare the ground for a better future? And that's a much more problematic question.
Well, that actually does go to the heart of it right now. Is this new Soviet, this new post-Soviet man, the nerds, as Peter called them, do they have a different value structure? And he seemed to think they do. It's rooted in their economic circumstances. It's rooted in the way they make their livings. And I want to actually go right away to a pretty interesting dichotomy that Peter drew, saying, taking issue with my contention of this ongoing battle between the power vertical and the power horizontal. He says something else is also going on here. And before we move to the last section, let's just hear what Peter had to say about that.
I don't think it's about horizontal or vertical. I think it's maybe a new Protestantism versus a sort of prison culture, a Zekovskaya kultura, which Putin represents, which Putin plays to a lot. So that's really the...
you could even see that in his language.
Conflict. Well, he imitates that on purpose. Yeah. So, I mean, and this is where you get this phrase, which I don't actually like, about the Russia of the chanson, the prison songs, versus the Russia of the iPhone. I don't like that because it's for a whole bunch of reasons. But there is something in that.
Oh, Kirill, I want to go to you with this, since you're our expert on all things religion. The new Russian Protestants, he wasn't speaking religiously, of course, but he was speaking in the terms of Weber's Protestant ethic against Russian prison culture. What do you think of that dichotomy?
I'm not sure that we can speak about this particular division between, you know, Russia of chanson and Russia of iPhone.
But let's put it in Peter's own words, because he was talking about the Russia's, what he calls Russia's new Protestants. These people that are working in the private sector and want things to be more rational and predictable against against Russian prison culture. That dichotomy was more, I think, is actually more interesting than the chanson versus the iPhone dichotomy.
I'm not sure that Russian private sector, private economy is such rational as everyone is thinking about this. But anyway, of course, it's much more rational than the absolutely pragmatic and at the same time irrational behavior of the not state economy. We can speak about state economy is in the traditional meaning of this word, but in the behavior of the state itself, of course. It's all about, first of all, rationality. And secondly, again, sorry for repeating all the time about the values.
I think values go to the heart of this, actually. And I think that goes to the heart of what Peter was talking about here and what we've been talking about in this entire segment. So I think the values is right on the money.
There are two sorts of rationality. First of all, first is, rationality as a, philosophical idea. And secondly, rationality as a consequence of a some sort or some way of religious thinking, say Protestant, Calvinist, and so on. And when we speak about this lack of rationality, of course, everyone is saying that Russia is, absolutely rational country. So "умом Россию не понять", as Fyodor Tutchev wrote, and so on. But in the very heart of this, of course, that is the, I'm not preaching, but that is a disaster, the consequences of the disaster of Russian Christianity, Russian Orthodox Church, during the imperial and then Soviet and then post-Soviet times. Because this lack of values, and rationalism is one of these most important values, is the result of this disaster. That is my first point. And the second point is, there is a contradiction between, this cult of rationality and common sense and so on among Moscow creative class. And even the very, the very strategy and even tactics of the political fight. You can't be rational if you want to, to overthrow the regime. You must have, I hate this word, but you must have charisma in some sense, yeah? You must be a real political leader as Navalny tries to be. But it's not a sort of extremely rational, you know, occupation or profession, and so on.
David, I want to go to you with the last word, because you've often said the crisis of Russia isn't one of politics or corruption. It is a crisis of values. Now, we've painted this picture here with Peter's help of this rising political class, these new Protestants, the nerds, the Big Bang Theory dudes. They seem to have different values. Is this part of is this attacking this deep underlying problem that I know that you've referred to in your work throughout your career?
Well, I don't know that they have different values. We know that they're caught up in a situation in which they cannot achieve their objectives for themselves, their goals, their ambitions. They are confronted every day with the irrationality of the system that has been created on the basis of the old values, with the domination of the state, the disregard for the individual. Whether they really understand that the country needs a new moral base, that's an interesting question. I mean, surely there are people who have always held that, and there are new people who have come to that conclusion. But it's on the successful resolution of that particular question that the whole future of Russia depends.
And it seems like, and as Kirill's pointed out, we seem to have, at least on the surface, what looks like a showdown of values. I mean, you have, if you take the Navalny campaign as a template, and whether that's fair or not, of one side, and you have the Kremlin with all this virtual postmodern smoke and mirrors, you do seem to have this clash of values going on right now. No,
I wouldn't overestimate that. I mean, it's one thing to talk about corruption, which Navalny does. And it's another thing to talk about specific injustices and the bankruptcy of the regime. That's all well and good. Those things are symptoms of a deeper problem. I mean, the Putin regime didn't appear in a vacuum. It came out of a specific attitude toward the individual that prevailed in Russia. I mean, we've just got done with marking the 20th anniversary of the attack on the White House in 1993. That wasn't carried out by Putin. That was carried out by Yeltsin. And as far as I'm concerned, everything that I've learned and understood about that was that that was a deliberate provocation carried out by the presidential side, by Yeltsin, the pro-Western leader, the leader who was lionized in the West, the supposed hero of democracy. So, I mean, what we have now, and that, of course, led to the rise of Putin, who was Yeltsin's hand-picked successor, and the authoritarian regime, which is now in place in Russia. Now, are we going to have, in opposition to the Putin regime, another Yeltsin who is going to take power and introduce the same abuses but in a slightly different guise?
That's, I guess, is the million-dollar question, and that is all we have time for today, folks. I would like to remind you, you've been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from London has been co-host Kirill Kobudin, editor of the history and sociology magazine NZ. Also joining us via Skype from Moscow has been special guest and veteran Kremlin watcher David Satter, a longtime Moscow correspondent, a fellow at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, and author of numerous books on Russia, including most recently, It Was a Long Time Ago and It Never Happened Anyway. Thanks for the great discussion, gentlemen.
Thank you.
And Peter, I hope you're listening. Thanks for joining us virtually. I'd also like to thank our brilliantly patient and patiently brilliant producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the super cool Twitter feed Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week, and now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.